Hi, this is Dr. Christopher Perrin, and welcome to this episode, which is part of the Christopher Perrin Show. In this podcast, I'd like to address the importance of staying the course on a good liberal arts education. About 4 years ago, I was invited to speak at a conference in Alberta, Canada, my first and only trip to Canada, and I was asked to address this topic, and I ended up writing an article about it, and I'd like to speak to you about it, the importance of, well, staying with something that can be challenging and difficult, and that is, well, educating your child or participating in the education of your child, giving that child a good classical and liberal arts education. A classical education, as we should know, seeks not so much to inform as to form. Everywhere in the classical tradition, we can note that by educating our children, we're seeking the formation of their souls and minds. In other words, we're seeking their character. And just as an aside, do you happen to know that that Greek word character comes from the die that would impress an image on a coin, something that you would press in and imprint? And so a character, of course, it can mean a letter because, the character G is a letter. It's a character. It used to be pressed in. Remember the old printing press? Well, that this is the reason why we're called Classical Academic Press here, where I work, because it used to be that the old printing press would push down, metal letters, going back to Ben Franklin and his printing press, pressing paper against the metal typed letters that were arranged to print a page. Okay, you get the point. When you have character, something has been deeply printed or imprinted upon you that is permanent. Character is a part of one of the great goals of education. Character is from that Greek word that means an engraving tool or an engraving itself, like an imprinted or minted coin. We talk about letters as characters because they used to be stroked into clay or wax or chiseled into stone. Figuratively, then, our character is that which is written on the tablet of our own heart. You can see Proverbs 2 for an interesting use of that metaphor. Put another way, character is an engraving or the minted imprint slowly pressed into the souls of our children. The tradition, the classical tradition, says that we're seeking wisdom, virtue, and eloquence. The well-educated person should be wise, virtuous, and able to bring an apt and timely word to every occasion. And when we pray for and seek to contribute to the formation of our children's character, we're seeking their wisdom, their virtue, and their eloquence. These are the three of the great aims of a liberal or classical education. Well, this process is a process. It's step by step. It's gradual. It's slow. It's not accelerated. It's not advanced. It's not advanced placement. It's rightly placed. It's ordered to the nature of the student, to the human. It is just right when ordered for formation in wisdom, virtue, and eloquence. And it can vary according to the specific nature of your student, which means wise guidance and direction at the hands of a wise teacher or magister. It means tutoring, which is why the tutorial system is widely regarded as the most effective means of educating a human and the most economically inefficient, meaning it's expensive. If you were to go to Oxford, say, that would be a great privilege, but you would have, say, two students for every tutor. Well, economically, that's expensive. Well, in this particular episode, I hope to convince you that a classical education is the rightly ordered pursuit of a rightly ordered soul in your children. The rightly ordered pursuit of a rightly ordered soul. Ideally, it's the harmonious pursuit of harmony. Like all good things, it takes time, and it comes with time. I hope I can convince you to take your time and the time needed to educate your children through the entire span that you are their custodians, their parents, their primary educators, and perhaps most importantly, their models. There will be times when it seems easiest to stop educating your children for formation and instead to school them for something less. For no longer does school mean education. Educatio and the Greek translation of educatio, paideia, did not mean schooling. It did not mean job training or vocational training. These words, educatio, paideia, they meant to lead out. They meant the formation of soul and character. And educatio from educare means to lead out or unfold. And paideia, which is related to the Greek word paidos, which means child, meant a full 360-degree education of the child involving family, teacher, the entire polis, the Greek town or city-state. Now, there will be times when you will be tempted to school your children for such things that will tempt you to school your children rather than to educate them as sports. And I'm not against sports at all. I participated in sports, as did my kids. But the opportunity for your child to go pro or to play Division I basketball, that can be a distraction, as can reputation, better grades, a shorter commute, or the money you would save if you enrolled your kid in a public school, and your children's wishes and requests, which begin usually, if they are to begin, at about age 13 or 14. Your children might want to go to school elsewhere, or if you're homeschooling them, they might want to go to school anywhere. In the U.S., we don't permit people to vote until they're 18. And this is not an insult to those who are 17 or younger. It's a recognition of what is universal. And that is this, that wisdom comes with age. So money, the opportunity for your child to get onto a bigger, better sports team, a shorter commute, a place where your children can just get better grades. All of these things can become temptations to change the way we educate our children and maybe to school them instead. Providing a classical education to your children in grades K through 6 is fairly easy, by the way, compared to the education that we give them in grades 7 through 12. And that's just something to note if you're kind of new to classical education. And why is it easier in grades K through 6? Well, the pedagogy and curriculum of the early grades is simply simpler. We focus on teaching reading and math, and we introduce children to the magic of reading and story and all of the virtue and wisdom that the great stories contain. We teach them grammar and Latin at a time when they find it very naturally fitted to who they are as budding readers and writers. Dorothy Sayre says somewhere that, you know, an inflected language is no more surprising than anything else in an astonishing world to these young children. We teach using songs and chants and demonstrations, nature study, lots of repetition, and forms of direct instruction. We teach them the rudiments, the foundational elements of things. And gifted teachers can easily learn how to do this. And that's true. I'm not saying that it's less important. In fact, I think you could make an argument that the early education is foundational and determinative for what comes later, but it is easier to learn how to teach as a lower school educator than it is in an upper school educator if you're in the liberal arts tradition. Let's keep going. The pedagogy and curriculum of the latter years is more difficult for us who have not received a classical education ourselves. So here's a key distinction. If you've had a good, robust classical education, then it will be easy for you to teach in any grade. But most of us have not received a robust classical education, and therefore it's more difficult for us to give it in the upper years. We have to essentially learn along with our children, and it becomes more difficult to help our children with their mathematics, their hard science courses, more advanced Latin, logic. How many of us have even studied logic and rhetoric? Who has studied rhetoric? And what of the inquisitive study of the great books like Plato's Republic, Virgil's Aeneid, Augustine's Confessions, Shakespeare's plays, or Dante's The Divine Comedy, all three books of The Divine Comedy? We might not be ready to do that well because of our own lacking educations. So, again, it's just easier if you're starting new to teach lower the lower grades than it is the upper grades in the classical tradition. The pedagogy is more challenging in the upper grades because we need teachers, ideally, who have mastered the upper school curriculum and have integrated it within their minds and persons. Have integrated it. What would it be like if, you know, every teacher at, say, a classical high school knew everything that a 12th grader knew, is just as well or better? For example, a 12th grader graduating from the local classical school in my area would know, have had several years of Latin, several years of logic and rhetoric, have read through a pretty good list of great books in literature, would have studied history in at least two repeating cycles chronologically through, say, 13 years of study, would be very well equipped in mathematics and the natural sciences. Well, what if some of these students know more than their teachers do? Well, okay, I hope you get the point here. Pedagogy is challenging to us. Most of us will not be able to do this alone as the sole teacher of our children. We will collaborate with either other teachers in a classical homeschooling co-op or at a classical school. The only way that most of us will have the power to stay the course through graduation will be if we travel in a community with other people, because we need others. Very few of us are equipped to teach everything well to any of our children in grades K through 12. So we don't want to do this alone. We want to do this in a community with other kindred spirits. We should not try to do this at home alone. We certainly should try to do this at home, but not alone. Many parents quit, however, in the upper school years, and often at the first sign of complaints and dissatisfaction by their children. But we should note that the students will usually complain at one time or another in their teenage years about any form of education that we give them. The chief reason that students complain, and often rightfully complain, about classical education is simply this: they're overburdened. In our enthusiasm for teaching them so much of the true, the good, and the beautiful, we try to teach them far too much of the true, good, and beautiful, far more than they can digest and understand, and we crush them with goodness. One reason they don't like school, any school, is that we ask them to study too many things at the same time. Sadly, this sometimes is the case even at our classical schools and homeschooling co-ops. I've written about this. You can see this on my Substack at christopherperrin.substack.com, or I've written an article called Piling It On. I have a podcast on it as well about how we just tend to do too much of a good thing. And that's kind of a hold on to the progressive model of education, where we dabble in a lot of things and kind of create a big buffet line that in itself you might think is good. Have you ever been to a good buffet line? But isn't usually the best way to educate. Of course you want children to be able to explore, etc., but you don't want 12 subjects at a time. But let me return to the expected complaints of our teenage children and their requests for a new school. Would you have your teenagers choose their diet and what they would eat? Would you have your teenagers choose their schedule, when they should sleep and rise? Would you have them choose what to watch and when on Netflix, YouTube, or any of the other streaming channels or on the internet generally? Would you have them choose when and where to drive? Would you have them choose their school and education? And many Americans would say to that question, why, sure. Would you have them choose what books to read and what subjects to study? Should they choose their own curriculum? What teenager on his own would be able to choose wisely what to read? Say, Plato, Shakespeare, Augustine, or Dante. Would they choose these things on their own? Some of us, because of our own poor education, are not even sure what we would choose to read. Well, of course children should increasingly have some agency, but they're children and they need guidance, guardians, tutors, parents, and teachers. Many American parents seem to assume that they have authority over their children until the time in which their children grow as tall as we parents, and then push back and complain, and then we cave. After all, they're as tall as we are. It can be challenging at times to stay the course of a classical education in the upper school years, but it need not be truly and persistently painful. In fact, these are the years when the fruit begins to appear in larger quantities on the tree, often in 11th and 12th grade. When students are completing their studies of rhetoric and mathematical studies, and they're starting to show some accumulating wisdom from reading and discussing so many great books. It's a sad thing to me to see a family pull the cake out of the oven shortly before it begins to rise, and often around 8th or 9th grade. A classical education has historically shown, and is showing now, substantial fruit in students who are blessed to receive it. A few years ago, the Association of Classical Christian Schools received the results of a substantial survey called the Good Soil Report, which you can find on the ACCS website. That's ACCS. It's classicalchristian.org. That's their website. The results of this survey, conducted by the sociology department at the University of Notre Dame, presented us with some really encouraging and positive results. The survey tracked and compared the results of students who graduated from public and private and secular schools, Protestant, Catholic, and classical schools, classical Christian schools. They surveyed graduates from the age of 24 to 42 years of age, and in virtually every category, at least the ones that matter, classical students excelled. They had higher SAT scores. They were the most likely to trust the Bible as well as to respect science. They were the most likely to express a care and concern for the environment. And they were the most likely to have LGBT friends while also being the least likely to support LGBT lifestyle. That's somewhat paradoxical, isn't it? And here's the kicker. While 70 to 80% of Christians abandon the church and the faith in their 20s, which is a crisis worth talking about, classically educated students retain their faith and commitment to the church at a rate of 80%. So from this survey, we could ask the question, do you want your teenager to keep the Christian faith? You might not know much about classical Christian education at present, but you should know that classically educated students, according to the survey, do keep the faith at an 80% rate when vast numbers of other Christian students do not. Now, I love teenagers and I love teaching them, knowing them, befriending them, but the world ought not to be run by them, as inspiring as they are. There's an old Star Trek episode called The Grups, that's short for grown-ups, in which Kirk and Spock visit a planet in which everyone under the age of 18 has mysteriously died of some disease, and the planet was entirely run by teenagers who ruled over the children. There were no grown-ups, no grups in the world. Well, it did not go well for Kirk and Spock when they visited this planet. Teenagers can inspire and lead us in various ways. Their opinions should be considered. Often they're wise beyond their years and have interesting perspectives, etc. But they are not yet mature or grown up. And their capricious and changing wishes and desires should not determine their education. Now, I will just modify this a bit and say, of course, their interests should be considered. Of course, they should be given some agency. They should have some segments and areas of life in which they get to choose what they can do and choice in terms of things that they read with good guidance and so forth. But they ought not to determine their own education. The secondary and primary things come to mind here. We want to make these kinds of distinctions. Yes, they should have some agency, but not complete agency over their education. Now, all of these things that I've mentioned, sports, reputation, better grades, shorter commute, saving money, and your children's wishes, are legitimate concerns that must be wisely judged. For example, there are some people who just simply can't afford to either homeschool or send their children to a private school. And so going to a public school is a viable option. I'm glad that there are lots of public classical charter schools emerging around the country where these are tuition free. There's nothing at all wrong with a student or a parent wanting a child to have the opportunity to, say, play soccer well or even to play at the highest level that he is capable of playing. And there's nothing wrong with wanting your child to receive good grades or for you to shorten your commute by choosing a nearby school or saving money to manage your budget, perhaps by choosing a public school. Nor is it wrong for your children to express their wishes, desires, and opinions about their own education. But are you convinced that an education is formation in virtue and of the highest value? If so, how do these other concerns compare with this highest concern? Can they truly be harmonized? I think they are in the relationship of the secondary things to the primary things, to what we used to call the first things. For a harmonized, ordered life, we must keep first things first. C.S. Lewis put it this way: when we put secondary things first, we not only lose the first things, but we lose the second things as well. In Proverbs 2, we find a tutor speaking to a student, a tutor of the best kind who was a parent, a father. In Proverbs 2, a father addresses his son. The advice he gives is the high-level advice that I think we all need in order to understand the overarching aim and goal of education. Wisdom. Wisdom is what the father urges upon his son. Wisdom is that supreme virtue that we no longer understand or can define. Wisdom is the great goal of a classical, liberal, liberating education. But what is wisdom? Wisdom is seeking after and coming to know the divine mind and the ways all things are ordered by the divine mind. Christ is the big W wisdom to which all small W wisdom leads. Hugh of St. Victor, that's in Paris, just, you know, from many centuries ago, describes it this way: wisdom is the living mind, primordial mind, the first order and pattern of all things. Who speaks this way? As we return to the source of the river, this living primordial mind, the fountainhead, we begin to understand God, ourselves, and creation. We begin to hear the celestial harmonies and the music of the spheres. This is how John Henry Newman put it when he describes the results of a classical or liberal arts education. He's writing in the mid-1800s. He says, "The perfection of the intellect, which is the result of education and its beau ideal, to be imparted in their respective measures, is the clear, calm, accurate vision and comprehension of all things, as far as the fine mind can embrace them, each in its place and with its own characteristics upon it." He goes on, "It's almost prophetic from its knowledge of history. It's almost heart-searching from its knowledge of human nature. It has almost supernatural charity from its freedom from littleness and prejudice. It has almost the repose of faith because nothing can startle it. It has almost the beauty and harmony of heavenly contemplation. So intimate is it with the eternal order of things and the music of the spheres." Now, this is elevated prose, to be sure. We don't even know what the music of the spheres is anymore. He's going all the way back to, this is something that Pythagoras wrote about, like 700 BC. He's describing this view that, this belief that when stars or planets were moving in the heavens, they were moving in harmonious, regular, beautiful patterns, and that perhaps they actually emitted a sound we couldn't hear, a music of the spheres. At any rate, you see here in Newman's quote that he's describing wisdom, that the result of an education like this is such that we have a harmony of heavenly contemplation. We have supernatural charity from our study of literature. We have heart-searching ability because of our reading of great books and literature. We've been delivered from littleness and prejudice, and we have even the repose of faith because nothing really surprises us, having read human history, etc. It's another way of saying wisdom. I've noted that we cannot allow children or teenagers to be the final arbiters of their education, and yet in Proverbs 2 we see that children and their yearnings are crucial to education. If students are not filled with studium, it's a Latin word that means zeal and affection for knowledge, for the true, the good, and the beautiful. If children, students, don't have studium, then they're not really students at all. The passage in Proverbs 2 makes it clear that students must themselves seek and find, meaning that we cannot seek and find for them. Here's what we read in Proverbs 2, the first six verses. My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments within you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding, yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God, for the Lord gives wisdom, and from his mouth come knowledge and understanding. Note the hypothetical syllogism there. It's if you seek, if you raise your voice, if you call out for insight, then you will understand the fear of the Lord, for the Lord gives wisdom. Yes, we pray for our children to become wise, but do we call on them to call on God? If you call out for insight, if you raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as hidden treasure, then you will understand and find. It's not enough that we pray for our children, even though we must do that. They must pray for themselves. If they won't seek, they won't find. So students ought not to choose the path of wisdom, their education, but they very much should cry out for it and seek it with all of their little hearts. This is a profound educational insight that comes to us in the tradition. The insight is that students must seek insight. The wisdom is that students must seek wisdom to get it. In the classical tradition, there are two main categories of mind, and thus two ways that we grow and are formed in wisdom. The medievals regarded our mind to consist of these two aspects, the ratio, I like rolling my R's, and the intellectus. Ratio is the discursive running part of our minds that collects, categorizes, classifies, and reasons logically. It's akin to scientific thinking. It's related to the word rational and rationality or reason, ratio. Intellectus is that part of our mind that gazes and contemplates and that thinks deeply. The Latin word intellectus did not mean high IQ, brainy, or above average intelligence. It referred to that capacity that every human has to penetrate and to understand reality by contemplation, by gazing, by pondering. Contemplation itself comes from contemplare, which means to gather in the temple. The templum is there. It's the place where, in the Roman and pagan context, the will of the gods was discerned, a set-apart, sacred place. We see the word used in this way in the biblical tradition in Psalm 27, for example, where David says, "One thing I've desired of the Lord, to dwell in the temple of the Lord, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord all the days of my life." This was an intellectual, contemplative exercise. The intellectual life in the classical tradition, therefore, may not be what you were thinking it was. The intellectual life is a life of seeing, gazing, and slowly coming to know the deep reality of things by a receptive, attentive engagement or contemplation. What has happened to contemplative learning or the contemplative life generally? It has been largely swallowed up by what Joseph Pieper calls the total world of work in his book, Leisure, the Basis of Culture. It is this kind of contemplative learning that is at the heart of loving the things that are lovely, the way that Augustine would define education, teaching children to love the things that are lovely or worth loving, to have our loves ordered. Children who learn to love the lovely, to order their loves wisely, they tend to love such an education and such a school and are not very, well, let me put it this way. They tend to love such an education, such a school, and are not very likely to complain and itch for something else if that school is ordering their affections and loves. The intellectual life can be compared to what we see of Mary, the sister of Martha, in Luke 10. Jesus is visiting the home of Martha and Mary. They are sisters of Lazarus. Martha is busy working in the kitchen, preparing or cleaning up after a meal. Mary is sitting with Jesus, wrapped in conversation. Martha approaches not Mary, but Jesus, and she says to him, "Please tell my sister to help me. Don't you care for me?" she says. And Christ responds, "Martha, Martha, you're busy about many things. Only one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen what is best, and it will not be taken from her." It's a very short passage at the end of Luke 10. There's much here about the nature of education, the lordship of Christ in education, about harmony and balance in education, and about staying the course in education. Christian education must be led by Christ the teacher. In fact, we can argue that all education is led by Christ, whether one realizes it or not. If Christ is who he is the one who brings illumination and light to every man. That's John 1. To learn anything that is true or good is already to be in contact with him who is the source of all that is true, good, and beautiful, although that's a topic for another time. Jesus makes it clear to Mary and to Martha that one thing is necessary. Thus, there is a hierarchy in education. What Martha was doing was not bad, but there's a hierarchy. Some things are more important than others. Some things are absolutely necessary. Some things are good and desirable, but not necessary. Let me return to your educational choices. Playing on a high-level soccer team is good. It is not necessary. Saving money is good, but not the highest good when it comes to the formation of your child's soul and character. What is the best thing? That is necessary. Hearing from Christ, conversing with Christ, and that leads us to his lordship. Christ is sitting with Mary in conversation, and the gospel passage describes Mary as sitting at Jesus' feet, listening to his teaching. He leads. He speaks with authority. He is the rabbi. He is the teacher. Martha, listening to Jesus' teaching, hearkens and takes us back to Proverbs 2. Is she not attentive to wisdom? And is she not inclining her heart to understanding as exhorted in Proverbs, as we're exhorted in Proverbs 2? Mary is seeking, she is attending to wisdom. And in this case, it's the big W, wisdom. Remember, Proverbs 2 goes on to read, "Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity and every good path, for wisdom will come into your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul." It's verses 9 and 10 from Proverbs 2. Can anyone doubt that Mary sat at Jesus' feet listening to his teaching, that wisdom was coming into her heart and that it was pleasant to her soul? Perhaps that's why she forgot about dinner. Perhaps it was this very thing that irritated Martha. There's Mary, gazing, contemplating, filling up with pleasant wisdom while she took care of all the dinner duties. And of course, yes, we have duties, even many duties in education. We have lesson plans, preparation, assessment, correcting papers, etc. But is everything directed by Christ the teacher such that we find ample time to sit at his feet? Will this happen or be supported well at the local public school? This passage also reminds us that education must be harmonized. It should be a harmony of active and contemplative learning. In the classical Christian tradition, both Martha and Mary are regarded as saints. What Mary was doing, preparing and serving, was not bad, not bad at all. It was simply not the right thing to do at that time. It was not the best part or the best option. We all must serve and prepare like Martha, and we all should serve Christ. Christ perhaps was over for hospitality and dinner and conversation with Mary and Martha. But there's also a time to sit contemplatively and passively at Christ's feet. And this is true of all education. There is active learning and contemplative, restful learning. We need both, just like we need Martha and Mary. The problem is this. We are all actively learning almost all the time. We are Martha educators, and we have forgotten how to learn as Mary does. It is clear that we need to be both Martha and Mary at various times. Another way of saying, we need to be prudent. Maybe we should be Martha most of the time, maybe 6 days a week. But one day we should rest and learn restfully. Maybe we should, Mary should remind us to employ a sabbatical pattern in education. An education that is at least 1/7 restful and contemplative. For this is the best part, and it shouldn't be taken from us. What if 1/7 of what we did in our classical schools and homeschools was restful and contemplative, following the sabbatical pattern? So I think I can safely predict that, like the rest of us, you are busy about many things. Like Martha, are you anxious about many things? It is good and right that you serve, that you're dutiful. This is what Augustine called active, benevolent love of neighbor. In other words, our love of neighbor, when we're commanded to love God with our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, and our neighbor as ourself, Augustine's saying that because we are commanded to love our neighbor, we should do as Martha does, but not all the time. It is good and right to be busy and serve, but it's not the best. If you're going to stay the course, you cannot be merely Martha, only Martha. You will tire and exhaust yourself. You will grow irritated. You will give in quickly when your teenager offers her first complaint and insists that she would be oh so happy at Smith High School, where she could join the huge theater program or the girls' soccer team or the swim team or fill in the blank. If you live only as Martha, you will not enjoy and be revivified by those refreshing times at Jesus' feet. To stay the course, you too must restfully learn, read, contemplate, and enjoy conversation with others. You may need a mom's group that meets once a month to discuss a great book in a lovely setting. You will need some skole, the Greek word that means undistracted time to study the things most worthwhile, usually with good friends, usually in a lovely place and with a good drink. So may I ask you, where is your Mary? Where is your inner Mary? She left the dishes to listen to Christ the teacher. She set aside the time to converse and contemplate. David too, King David, I mean, by the way, made time. David was a pretty busy executive as the king of Judea. He knew that he could not possibly dwell in the temple of the Lord all the days of his life, but he wanted to. It is David who wrote most of the Psalms that we have in the book of Psalms. Imagine our president, whoever he might be or she might be, writing poetry, psalms, or prayers. But King David did. Can you? David had a strong desire to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord in his temple, and Mary had such a compelling desire to be with Jesus that she broke the social norms of dinner preparation and serving, forgetting her own sister for a moment, to be with Jesus. Imagine a server at a restaurant becoming so engrossed with a conversation at your table that she pulls up a chair, joins your discussion, and forgets about bringing you your coffee and dessert. The 20th century writer Simone Weil, last name is spelled W-E-I-L, by the way, The 20th century writer Simone Weil noted that all real study must be led by desire. The word desire comes from de and sederis, two Latin words, essentially meaning that which is born of the stars, for sederis means a constellation of stars. Desire, therefore, is a version of twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are, at least etymologically speaking it is. Desire has its root etymologically in the stars. Here's how Simone Weil puts it. Contrary to the usual belief, willpower has practically no place in study. The intelligence can only be led by desire. For there to be desire, there must be pleasure and joy in the work. The intelligence only grows and bears fruit in joy. The joy of learning is as indispensable in study as breathing is in running. Where it is lacking, there are no real students, but only poor caricatures of apprentices who, at the end of their apprenticeship, will not even have a trade. It is the part played by joy in our studies that makes of them a preparation for spiritual life, for desire directed towards God is the only power capable of raising the soul. Or rather, it is God alone who comes down and possesses the soul, but desire alone draws God down. He only comes to those who ask him to come, and he cannot refuse to come to those who implore him long, often, and ardently. Now, I think you can see that we are back, if you haven't noticed, to Proverbs 2. Solomon says that we should call out loud for insight and raise our voice for understanding and seek it like silver and search for it as hidden treasure. Simone Weil says we should implore the Lord long, often, and ardently. We can conclude then, we must lead our children as the principal educators, modeling our own seeking and finding of wisdom, our own holy and ardent desire. We must model for them the seeking after wisdom, for we never stop growing in wisdom, do we? Our children must see us crying out and searching, seeking, and finding wisdom. How can we ask them to call out for wisdom when we don't do it ourselves? We as teachers and parents then must continue to be students, full of studium, zeal for the true, the good, beautiful for knowledge. A teacher is just a more mature student. A student is just an immature teacher. If we wish our teachers, if we wish our students to stay the course and complete a classical education and be formed as Christians, we must stay the course and be ever growing, ever learning, ever seeking, and finding. We must be fully alive to our own ongoing love affair with wisdom and Christ the Logos, in whom all things consist and cohere, Christ the power and the wisdom of God. This concludes this episode. I want to thank you for your time and your attention. I really appreciate it. So thanks for either watching or listening. You can find more of my presentations, both what I write on Substack.com, Christopher Perrin at .substack.com, and my podcast at The Christopher Perrin Show, which you can find just about on any distribution channel. You can also find some of my lectures at ClassicalU.com. Once again, thanks for your attention. I'd like to thank you for watching or listening to The Christopher Perrin Show. And to do that, I can give you a coupon code that will give you 10% off on anything that you might care to order at classicalacademicpress.com. And the coupon code is simply CPSHOW. Thanks again for listening or watching.